There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Ros Atkins has hosted coverage of many major stories around the world for BBC News, including the death of Nelson Mandela, Barack Obama's first election victory. He's presented World Have Your Say on BBC TV and radio for many years. He's maybe best known for Outside Source, which is noted for what the BBC calls state-of-the-art touchscreen technology. It's used to access and illustrate developing news stories, and he is here. Ros, nice to meet you.
Nice to see you both. Thanks for having me.
Very good to have you here. So why, first of all, tell us, what are you doing here in Dubai? What's
brought you? I'm here to host a Marketing Society event, which is taking place tomorrow. The Marketing Society is a London-based organisation, but it recently set up in Dubai as well. And tomorrow is its first major event based in here. In fact, they've got events in Dubai, London and New York tomorrow happening simultaneously. And I'm helping to host the Dubai leg of that event.
Okay, so you've been doing lots of, you've been kept very busy by the BBC recently. You've been doing stuff on Brexit, but as Tim mentioned, Outside Source is perhaps where you might most be well known to a world BBC world audience. And for anyone who's not seen it, you're sort of stood in front of a screen. It's a bit like a giant iPad, and you click on somewhere and it might be a bit of news, it might be some trending, something that's gone viral or something from around the world. Why has there been a move towards using such digital ways to deliver the news at the BBC?
Well, I think a few years ago, there was an idea that TV and radio were going to evaporate as the digital world marched on. And as has become quite clear, people still want to watch lots of TV and radio, and the BBC's figures bear that out. I'm sure your figures do as well. But it was also clear that we needed to create television that was more comfortable in the digital world and which offered a proper outline of the best information that there is on any given story. So I don't want you to be in a situation where you're watching BBC World News and you think, well, actually, I can get better information through my phone than I can through this television news service. And so I wanted to create a program where I could access all of the best information on any given story, whether it came in the form of a map or a newswire or a still or a video clip or a live video feed or a tweet or a Facebook post or an Instagram post, or the list goes on and on and on. And through this bespoke technology, which we built for this big touchscreen that I have in the middle of the BBC newsroom, as I go through a story, I can pull in whatever it is we think is the most valuable information. So if you imagine that the number of sources available to all of us has multiplied exponentially because of the internet, I guess Outside Source is my way of saying, in the digital world, let BBC News be your guide. Come with us and I'll help sift through all of this information that you haven't possibly got time to read, and trust us, because people do trust us, to give you the best information on these stories.
That's the thing now, isn't it? There is so much information there. I can't keep on top of what my kids are having for lunch, let alone try to keep on top of what's going on in the world. But technology is a simple enabler. Let me give you an example, actually. Sherlock Holmes, BBC show? I think it is.
Certainly
a BBC
is.
Show. There's a very simple little technique in that when a character receives a text,
the text pops up on the screen,
and it drags that story kicking and screaming into the 21st
century. Do you want to know
a
bit of BBC jargon?
That's brilliant.
Now, whenever any programme uses that type of on-screen graphic, inside the BBC it's called a Sherlock.
Oh, that's
there you go.
See, but that kind of brings it forward, and that's kind of what Outside Source does. You kind of get to sift through all these different opinions, and because you've got opinions coming in from all over the world, you then make your own mind up, and all you're doing is saying, look, follow me through this maze.
Yeah, because if you go back even 10 or 15 years, the number of sources of information available to all of us would have been much more limited. And it can feel, you've just alluded to it, it can feel overwhelming, can't it? We all live busy lives. We haven't necessarily got the time to sift through the 150 different bits of information on the latest Trump-Russia development. But at the same time, you don't want a television news program which feels disconnected from the digital life that you lead. And so I guess I'm trying to position Outside Source in a sweet spot between the desire for someone to help you and the desire for broadcast news to feel like it fits into your digital life. And that's how I'm trying to pitch the program.
And with that in mind, how do you go about looking at what stories are going to make it on then? So if you're trying to appeal to maybe a UK audience and a wider global audience, how do you know well, this might be ticking the box here, this might be important in another part of the world. How do stories make it onto outside source?
Well, we're not trying to skew it towards the UK. We broadcast in the UK, but we're unashamedly a programme with a global news agenda. So the lead story in the UK would not automatically even get onto the programme. Probably would most days, but that wouldn't necessarily follow. We've got a lot more data than we've ever had, and I've become very interested in data in the last 2 or 3 years, not just in terms of how we can tell stories, but in how we choose stories. And so there's a big, what we call a dashboard, where we can see how people are consuming BBC News content via the BBC News website, the BBC News app, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, and so on. So we've got a huge amount of data that tells us stories that are generating huge amount of interest and stories which aren't. For example, Brexit, which I think before the referendum, as we were going into the campaign, a few of us were a little sceptical about whether people beyond the UK and certainly beyond the EU would be interested in this. All of our data started to show us, actually, we're getting record numbers from the Caribbean, from Southern Africa, from the Middle East, and so on. And so data is a huge part of it. But of course, there is the editorial process that you'll go through here, and which every news organization goes through, where you try and assess, well, how relevant does this feel to a global audience's life? And so if you take stories like Brexit, well, it's not just about saying this has happened in the House of Commons or this has happened in Brussels. It's about explaining to someone watching in Indonesia or in Nigeria or in Mexico, this is relevant because it's relevant to the future of the UK and the EU, and these countries interact with the UK and the EU, so this is going to have a ripple effect beyond. Equally, if you're talking about the minutiae of the Trump-Russia story, which is getting a huge amount of attention, unless you're a real student of it, the detail can become a bit overwhelming. So I think one of our jobs is to say, if we think this is important, we can't just report what's happening. We have to take the time on Outside Source to explain why this connects to the lives of people watching around the world. So if you're a regular viewer of the programme, you'll quite frequently hear me saying, I don't try and hide it, I'll say, and the reason this matters is, and then we'll have a whole section of the story helping people to get how it fits into their life, because we need to surface that. We need to surface the reason it's relevant. Otherwise, it's just an event which can sometimes seem quite a long way away from one viewer's life.
How much of a student of news are you? I watched a little piece of film with you today, and you were taking questions from people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. People just asking you, and it's 5 or 6 years old, I think, this piece of film, but it was people asking you questions just about you and about the program. And you said on there, look, I really am a student of news. Mm. I kind of always have been. Do you need to be that to do the job that you do?
I think you do. I think you do for two reasons. One is you need to have a very broad knowledge of what's happening in the world, and that's not something you can gen up on in one morning. You need to accumulate that knowledge over years. And I think our industry is in such a fluid position, both in terms of broadcast media and in terms of journalism more broadly. If you aren't thinking really hard about what does news mean, how do we define it, how do we produce it, how do we distribute it in a world that's changing by the month, let alone the year, how are you going to make programs that are broadcasting to a standard that your audience would expect? So for me, my job feels part journalist and part keeper of the format, if you like. I spent a lot of time thinking about what is Outside Source, how is it evolving, how do we make sure it still fits into people's lives. But you're quite right. I mean, I used to go to bed in my teens with the news on the radio, and I would leave it on all night, and I'd wake up and it would still be going in the morning. And I did that.
Did it work? Did it drift in overnight?
I don't know if it drifted in. It just maximized my consumption time. And it was all going fine until I met my wife, and she said, "This is not happening. It's going off." So I don't listen to the news through the night anymore, but I do look at the news not long before I turn the lights off, and I would definitely look at the news within a few minutes of getting up, and I'm consuming it all the time, because I think if you're going to be a serious journalist reporting on global affairs, you need to be soaked in these matters.
Let me the break.
Yes, of course.
That's great. Ros Atkins has hosted coverage of many major stories around the world for BBC News. I want to talk to you about the controversial news story, and there are a number of examples at the moment. The first one, I suppose, is clearly the Trump-Russia situation. We have a whole host of fake news, hashtag fake news issues. Somebody texts in, no name on this, your view on the CNN versus Fox debate, and it really is, I suppose, that's the divide, the opinion-based reporting, the agenda-style reporting. Is that a thing that is here to stay, or is that a fad for now, or is it just an American style, as somebody else texts?
Well, there are different laws in different countries about how TV news networks can carry on. So, for instance, Fox News doing what it does in the US would not be able to do that in the UK, for instance. UK broadcasters have to be seen to be neutral. So whether it's ITN or Sky or BBC, we have rules that we have to follow. It so happens the BBC wants to be neutral anyway, so that's not a problem for us. If whether Fox and CNN are going to be around in the medium term, I would say they definitely are. Cable news, including MSNBC and ABC and all of the others, is an integral part of the political fabric of the US, and they are not going anywhere. I think some people at CNN would definitely take issue with the idea that you have a political divide and on one side you have Fox and on one side you have CNN. I don't think those networks would necessarily define their position within journalism as such. But if you are saying, is TV news going to remain central to US politics? It absolutely is, because a lot of the biggest figures in the digital world are ones who have become big figures via TV cable news. Now, 10, 15, 20 years down the track, we might see some changes. But in the immediate term, Sunday morning on the US cable network still does a huge job of setting the week's political agenda. How the networks cover these stories matters to a lot of Americans, not least the president himself. And I don't see that changing in the near future at all.
But do you think, as a journalist, for you, is there not some worry that people will only watch what they want to watch as partisan, and they're not exposed to anything other than the opinion they already have?
Well, it is true that in some circumstances, and we see this both in how people act on Facebook and in how they choose their TV, sometimes you do like to go and hear an opinion that confirms what you already think. But actually, BBC News has done lots of research, for instance, around affluent millennials, so people in the top quarter of incomes in a number of different countries around the world. And we're seeing lots of research now which says that these people, for example, want trusted news sources who they believe will assess what's happening in their world and tell it to them straight. They don't want someone who's just going to confirm what they think. And so there's lots of evidence now. And if you see, for instance, how BBC News is doing on social media, whether it's through Twitter or Facebook, you've got millions and millions of people who aren't coming to us because we confirm their worldview. They're coming to us because they trust us to assess what's happening in their world. So I think it's a, I wouldn't say these two things are mutually exclusive. I think it's perfectly normal for people to, in one breath, want some things which confirm what they think, and in another breath want someone like BBC News to come along and say, well, here's a neutral assessment of the situation.
Journalism's in a particularly odd situation, though, at the moment, isn't it? You have the President of the United States who pushes, a fake news agenda, believes that many organisations are not publishing the truth, and in the same breath looks at the BBC and CNN and says, you are fake news. It doesn't seem to want a balanced news coverage. I find that an odd... I can't square that at all.
I think Donald Trump's comments on journalism have been abrasive and in some cases unhelpful. I don't think I'm undermining the BBC's neutrality to say that when journalism as a whole is attacked, that I as a BBC journalist would think that's not necessarily a helpful thing, because it's our firm belief at BBC News that objective quality journalism enhances the societies in which it exists, and we would want that in all of the countries we broadcast to. And so our belief in the importance of that type of journalism must, you know, make itself heard. And so I think if a president comes out and lambasts an entire industry, then I think that is something we would say, well, I don't think that's reasonable. If the president says, I don't like the particular analysis of this event, well, we're not going to start pushing back at President Trump for that, because he's perfectly entitled to his opinion. But I do think in an environment when the number of information sources we have multiplied, as we've already discussed, and where a lot of those news sources we barely know. New news organizations, individuals in countries we don't know, the list goes on and on. The need for a presence for trusted sources of information increases, not decreases. And I think BBC News and others perform very important services to all countries who wish their people to have information which helps them live their lives.
And if we can just take it back to you personally, you've covered lots and lots of big news stories around the world. Mm-hmm. What's probably been your favourite, or the thing that you've managed to get your teeth into that you've really enjoyed over your career?
Well, I used to live in South Africa, and I've been lucky enough to go back to South Africa many, many times reporting for the BBC. I have a particular connection in Soweto, where I've stayed many times, which is a town, stands for Southwest Township. It's in the southwest of Johannesburg. And I went back many times reporting on a number of different stories, but by chance, I was on a plane to Johannesburg the night that Nelson Mandela died. So I got off, I kind of woke up, turned on my phone at 6 a.m, and my phone was full of messages saying Nelson Mandela's died. And I was able to go back to Soweto to a guest house where I'd stayed many times, and we already had studio lines set up in case this was going to happen, because we knew, obviously, he was a very old man and a man who wasn't very well at the time. And from 7 a.m, as the sun was coming up in Soweto, I was able to broadcast just across the road from the street where Nelson Mandela had lived for many years, one of these small brick houses in Soweto with a little low terracotta roof. And what we saw unfold completely dumbfounded most of the international journalists who were there, because everyone had expected this heavy mood with a huge outpouring of grief, with sadness hanging in the air. And it turned very quickly into this huge celebration. So all of these resistance songs from the 1980s were being sung, and people were saying, I haven't heard people sing these songs for many years. Then the ANC set up a temporary stage on the back of a truck by the house and set up a sound system, and then more and more people arrived. Just turned into this celebration of this man's life. And I was saying to them, this wasn't what I was expecting. And they said, well, this was what we were expecting, because we knew he was going to die. We loved him dearly, but he's into his 90s. We knew he wasn't well. This isn't a time for sadness. This is a time to celebrate what he had achieved. And this completely took me aback. And so I spent the whole day on Vilakazi Street in an area of Soweto called Orlando West. And it's runs down the side of a hill. And as you stand in it, you can look across a valley to all these hundreds and hundreds of identical houses across the township. And listened to these people sing and party, and then night fell, and I carried on reporting into the evening, and I ended up at 2 o'clock in a bar on Vilakazi Street with a couple of hundred people in a big tent that had been set up outside a bar, with them continuing to sing all of these songs from the 1980s and to sing Nelson Mandela's name. And I thought, well, this is quite something to witness. I'll just say that that was about 10, 11 days. I think that was on a Thursday night, and then I think he died on Thursday night, so this was on a Friday, and then the funeral was on 2 Sundays later, so 9 days later. And I was broadcasting from a football stadium in Alexandra, another township in Johannesburg, where Nelson Mandela lived when he first moved to Johannesburg. And we'd seen all the dignitaries arrive. We saw them on the big screen, because the funeral was in the southwest of South Africa. And then there was the footage of the coffin being brought towards the place where he was going to be buried. And there had been singing, and there had been dancing, and there had been talking. And frankly, some people had been distracted in the crowd, as it's quite a long event. Mm. And then there was this moment where the coffin became visible and the whole stadium went quiet. And you could hear a pin drop across Alexandra, and I suspect across South Africa. And all of that celebration that I've been describing came to an end for a moment when I think the magnitude of what was happening sunk in. And I always remember Ahmed Kathrada, an ANC colleague of Nelson Mandela's who recently died, unfortunately, and who I interviewed a few years back. He spoke at Nelson Mandela's funeral, and he said, "My life is a void, and I don't know what to do." And I always remember him saying that line, and the whole place just stopped. Because I think at that point, South Africa realized that the man who'd been guiding them along this extraordinary path was saying to them, it's time to go on alone.
That's a moment in time. Roz Atkins is from the BBC. You'll know him from Outside Source. Really good to talk to you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.